stripped me dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family, will they be alright? Will they make it on the island for another night?
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
This is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Compromise.
On May 12th, the United Nations General Assembly elected the United States to serve on the UN's Human Rights Council. Many human rights activists in the U.S. and abroad welcomed the election as a significant reversal of U.S. policy under the Bush administration. Although under Bush's policy, the council was largely ignored, questions still remain on how the U.S. will use its seat to advance a nonpartisan and objective human rights agenda. In this episode, we speak with Jamil Dakwar of the ACLU about the U.S.'s election to the UN Human Rights Council, domestic human rights issues, and the impact of this election on domestic human rights advocacy. We'll also continue our focus on the U.S. so-called war on terrorism by looking at the case of Issa Noor Siddiqui, an American-born Muslim charged with conspiracy to provide material support for terrorism. In April of 2006, Shifa was taken from Bangladesh, transported to the United States, and placed in a federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia. Shifa traveled to Bangladesh to get married. He was 19 years old at the time. For the last 3 years, Shifa has been held in solitary confinement without a trial. Shifa's family says he is the victim of political and religious profiling and discrimination instigated by the U.S. government towards Muslim Americans. They say the U.S. government plans to convict Shifa based on his strong religious views, expression of those views, his objections to U.S. foreign policy, and his objections to U.S. treatment of disenfranchised people like Muslims around the world. Ajamu Baraka speaks with Shifa's sisters, Sunali and Charmaine Siddiqui, after a visit with their brother.
So Charmaine, tell me, share with our listeners a quick update on the case at this point.
So the case has been kind of stagnant. A lot of motions and other things being filed. Recently, the defense has filed a bond. Because my brother's situation at the prison is very, very, his health is deteriorating very fast. He was assaulted at the prison by a dangerous inmate who was the client of the former my brother's former attorney, whom my brother wanted to remove from the case last year. At this point, there are a lot of secret evidences that my brother has not been allowed to see. He doesn't know a lot of the evidence that are against him, all the materials that the government has against him, which has been problematic for the defense and for my brother. Even the lawyers sometimes are allowed to see them, but they are not allowed to discuss these issues or the materials that the government has with their clients, with my brother. We are hoping there might be we're hoping for a bond hearing. We'll find out later this week if the judge will have a hearing because we would like to have him home with us so he can regain his health, mental health and physical health, and prepare for his trial and help his counselors to prepare for the trial that is coming up in August.
The government claims to have evidence that because of their claims to secrecy, that evidence
right.
has not been shared with the defense.
Some of the evidence that the lawyers have seen, but the lawyers are not allowed to discuss it with their clients, with my brother.
Okay, which raises some due process questions, I guess, in terms of one's ability to confront evidence against oneself. Tell me, what impact has this had on you and the rest of your family?
Okay, let me turn to my sister, Sunali. Maybe she can highlight some of this stuff.
Well, it's been
pretty devastating. I think we've all been experiencing in our own ways, just really just feeling empty on a day-to-day basis without without his presence here with us. It's really hard to see my parents feel so stressed out. I know that they themselves are also experiencing health conditions like ulcer and high blood pressure and a lot of just the stresses that comes from having a family member ripped away from us, and especially with the Shifa, he was always with one of us, whether it be my mom or my dad or my brother or me, at different times in his life. Our day-to-day life has been interrupted as well. It's been pretty devastating overall.
Okay.
If I can add a little bit more to Sonali's, like the way he was kidnapped from Bangladesh, that was like really shocking and traumatic for not only him, but we were also traumatized by that, how somebody could be just snatched up on the street and we did not know for like 4 or 5 days where he was. So we were like all crazy and looking for him. So this has mentally, psychologically affected us. Seeing him incarcerated is like, we are also incarcerated with him.
Both of you have also mentioned that the conditions of confinement have been such that is having taking a toll on him both physically and mentally. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes, he is locked inside solitary confinement for 23 hours, usually sometimes 24 hours. It's like a 7 or 8 by 8 feet and 12 feet, a cell with no windows, and the doors are monitored electronically. It's the size of a bathroom that he's there every day for like 3 years now. So he has significantly affected his physical health. He has lost a lot of weight. Actually, his health has significantly began to deteriorate since after he was assaulted in the head in last October. Mm. He locked himself inside the cell for a month after the assault because he was afraid to leave and for future attack on him. So the mental health has also deteriorated because he is in continuous fear at the prison. So the safety and security concerns him and us at the prison. Yeah, what else can all you want to add?
I mean, I know that another thing that we hear about is just some of the food that's also being served to him. In a way, it's actually just breaking down his health even more.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually, like just today when we visited him, he was saying that he took a couple of bites of the cereal that they served him, and the cereal, it was a Frosted Flakes, but the flakes themselves were dark and grayish in color, and it actually tasted unusually chemically. And after a few bites of eating that, he felt extremely drowsy. And it was, to him, it was really unusual. Like, usually when he has cereal during the other days, it's not like that. Mm-hmm. And he's also communicated that there's certain food that's being served to him that looks unusual and it smells unusual, and it's not like how it used to be, even like 6-7 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and also he's when we go see him, he's shackled in his hands and feet. He wears like a orange color suit, just like the detainees of Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have regular. We began to have until March. We did not have any contact visit. It was only on religious, like twice a year. We would actually could see him face to face. So it was usually through a video conference kind of thing, way that we usually visited him until like March. Since March, we do have a regular, it's like every other week, we are able to see him face to face. But he's still shackled in his hands and feet. He's unable to open up the cans that we buy from the vending machine for him to eat or drink. I know his attorneys also have to like turn the pages for him because he's shackled in his hand. So it's very painful for us to see him this way. He has not even committed any crime, even a minor crime anywhere in the world. And he has not even appeared in a trial here, but he's being treated and punished this way. It's very painful for us to see that.
It's almost like, David, there's the assumption that he's actually already been convicted.
Yes.
And it's now like already serving time.
Let me ask this question. So you shared that the trial is scheduled to begin in August, and you are trying to seek a bond to at least bring him home, and so that he can prepare himself mentally and legally for the trial. Do you?
Right.
What is your feeling about the possibility of that happening?
We're hopeful that the court will see and understand his situation. The court is aware of him, that he was a stalker, and he's living in fear of the prison, and his health conditions have been made aware to the court. And hopefully, we are hopeful that the judge will let him out so he can physically regain, mentally regain his strength and prepare for the trial. It's a very complicated trial that's coming up. So we'd appreciate people's support, and hopefully the court will see it that way as well.
How can our listeners get more information on this case?
Yes, there is a website. It's www.freeshifa, free as in F-R-E-E, and S-H-I-F-A, freeshifa.com, where we have some information about the legal aspect of the case. We have some background information about Shifa and the family. And then other things people, public supporters can also help out by writing letters to the warden, to the attorney general, and to the judge about improving the conditions of his confinement, requesting him to give him a bond so he can return to the family and regain his health.
We'd like to thank Charmaine and Sonali again for sharing their family's story with us. We will keep you updated on this case. For more information, go to freeshifa.com. Again, that's freeshifa.com. There is also an online petition the family asked supporters to sign, and you can find that on www.ipetition.com/petition/freeshifa. Again, that's www.ipetition.com/petition/freeshifa, S-H-I-F-A. Another organization, Project Salaam, also has a petition to the Obama administration that includes addressing Shifa's prison conditions. This petition can be found on their website at projectsalaam.com. Again, that's www.projectsalaam.com. Now we'll move into the next part of our show. On May 12th, the United Nations General Assembly elected 18 new countries to serve on the UN Human Rights Council, based in Geneva, Switzerland. For the first time, the United States sought a seat on the council. The U.S. will join the 47-member council and serve a 3-year term starting next month. On the day of the election, Ajamu Baraka speaks with Jamil Dakwar, the director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program. Jamil has more than 10 years' experience in human rights litigation and advocacy in the U.S. and abroad. He's also co-chair of the American Constitution Society's Working Group on International Law and the Constitution, which examines U.S. compliance with human rights obligations and the incorporation of international human rights law into domestic U.S. law.
Jamil, today the General Assembly voted the U.S. on to the Human Rights Council. What do you think that means for the work of the council?
I think that this is an important addition to the Council because of the fact that the U.S. government has played a crucial role, historical role, in the creation of the Human Rights Commission that was reformed and replaced by the Human Rights Council. And in that sense, it is important to have the U.S. On around the table and as part of the highest UN human rights body. On the other hand, it also important to stress that this is just the beginning for the U.S. re-engagement with international bodies, with human rights bodies, and we have not yet seen the Obama administration responding and fully addressing the key human rights issues, especially domestic human rights issues.
Well, how did you respond to the argument on part of some elements in the U.S. that the Human Rights Council is basically irrelevant, that to bring the prestige of the U.S. to the Council was to waste the prestige of the Council because the Council basically is irrelevant and compromised?
I think it is a matter of a political will. If the governments, and mainly the governments that are truly committed to human rights, can work together to improve and make the Council more effective, that will happen. If there's no political will and the Council will remain a forum where countries will not take seriously human rights commitments, then this will be a disregarded and discredited Council. I think the U.S. government has to come to this Council with a good faith and an open to ideas and respect other countries' suggestions on how to make the Council more effective. And more importantly, the U.S. government has much to do under the Obama administration to improve U.S. credibility and reputation in the world. And I think a good first step would be to look at incorporate human rights into domestic policy. And that's something that is an area that has not seen a lot of action by the Obama administration yet.
Well, on that issue of credibility, some people have raised the concern that it appears that even under the Obama administration, that the U.S. still is attempting to pick and choose where it will engage the international community. As we know, the administration did not come to Geneva for the Durban Review process because of various issues we won't get into here, but the argument is that if the U.S. is reluctant to engage in difficult conversations, tackling difficult issues, with the possibility that it might decide to disengage and perhaps even leave the table of conversation, that the U.S. occupying this seat is risky. How do you respond to that?
I think that, again, the U.S. government has made a decision to join the Council. It made a decision and made pledged and made commitments, human rights commitments, to that it made. We think that those commitments were inadequate. We think that there's much more to be said about U.S. action and U.S. commitment, particularly to honor its international human rights commitments and treaty obligations. I think that the U.S. government has in a way, in the very beginning, and the Obama administration has not sent a clear message as to how they want to respond to a number of human rights issues, including domestic human rights issues. We have seen it in the area of national security, where notwithstanding the commitment to close Guantanamo and end torture, we have not seen enough on the accountability level, on the side of holding officials accountable to human rights standards, and particularly on the engagement of the U.S. government in torture. We have not seen enough on what the U.S. government will do with regard to the rendition program and a number of issues. And also we have yet to see the U.S. government address key domestic human rights issues, like, for example, the establishment of enforcement and monitoring mechanisms, ratifying human rights treaties that have not been ratified or even signed by the U.S. government.
Well, let's stay with that for a minute. We are very much concerned about the domestic human rights scene. And you mentioned that with the U.S. rejoining the Council, that will, in fact, strengthen domestic human rights. What way will that strengthen the advocates within the U.S.?
I think that people in the United States should hold the U.S. government accountable to its international commitments, and those the human rights rhetoric that is being used abroad should be used as a way to shed light on domestic human rights crises and problems. And for example, in the Gulf Coast, the lack of a full comprehensive human rights approach to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Rita is an issue that is yet to be taken up by the Obama administration. We have not seen yet the response to the immigration rates and a number of issues, including the problems in the immigration detention and the abuses that are occurring there. So there's a number of burning domestic issues that we have not seen a strong human rights commitment. And what we say human rights commitment is that U.S. government will take a holistic approach to addressing those domestic civil rights, civil liberties issues, and using human rights as a way to promote and respect and protect people's rights on the number of issues. The stimulus plan, for example, has been at the center of the government's attention, and yet we haven't seen the stimulus plan used, or at least have not seen enough of how the U.S. government will be using that to promote full equality in the distribution of those funds, so that people who are disadvantaged, poor, and community of color would be receiving those funds and would be able to improve the quality of education, and as an example.
With the U.S. joining the council again, does that imply then that U.S. Human rights advocates would not attempt to raise critical issues with the U.S. in that international forum because it might, in fact, embarrass the U.S.?
On the contrary, I think we are now in a better position as human rights advocates in the U.S. We have yet another forum where we can hold the U.S. government and the Obama administration accountable for its commitments at the international level. We will look forward to engage with the Obama administration. We will look forward to see how the Obama administration will re-engage with the international community and with countries on a number of issues. And we are hoping that this will be the beginning of a turning and shifting the policy on both domestic and international level.
Well, we want to agree with that, and we share that hope, Jamil, and I think all of our listeners also. So we want to thank you for joining us for this very brief conversation. We will definitely have you back again for one of our podcasts. So thank you, Jamil Dock, who is the director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program.
Thank you so much.
Executive Director Ajamu Baraka has issued a statement on the new seat the U.S. will hold on the UN Human Rights Council. You can find this and other information on our website at www.ushrnetwork.org. Again, that's www.ushrnetwork.org. Thank you for listening to No Retreat, No Compromise. Stay tuned for May 27th's episode on the death penalty, when we'll bring you updates on death row inmates Troy Davis and Mumia Abu-Jamal. No Retreat, No Compromise is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Special thanks to Sugar Matthews for her song featured in this podcast.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is the commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility.